I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. The thing I want to talk about today is some of the myths, really, that exist around Hitler's economic policy and the general kind of economic robustness of Germany in the 1930s and, obviously, during the war years. In 2006, Adam Tooze, who you'll have heard me sing his praises on a number of occasions... wrote a pretty groundbreaking book, Wages of Destruction, following in the line of other economic historians of Nazi Germany, particularly the Marxist economic historian Tim Mason, looking at the kind of the economic realities versus the economic myths that were propagated by Nazism, myths that we, you know, decades and decades after the end of the Second World War, still happily consume. Now, the debate about the economy of the Third Reich, I believe, has largely been resolved, but it doesn't prevent myths and assumptions filtering into kind of mainstream discourse. And the way that Adam Tooze sets it out is he says that actually Nazi Germany was nowhere near economically robust enough to go to war, and it had a series of economic crises throughout the 1930s based around rearmament. And the central dilemma of the Nazis at war was that they were in a race to smash and grab as much territory and resources as possible. But obviously, when the war turns against them, it's these territories that provide the living standards of Germans. They really asset strip Europe. You have countries such as Belgium and the Netherlands with half the material goods and standards of living that they had in 1939 by about 1943 or so. But yes, as these victories are rolled back, so the economic viability of Germany declines and declines, and obviously you've got to factor in heavy bombing into that as well. So there is a great review of the book in Richard J. Evans' essays, The Third Reich in History and Memory. And that's basically where I'm going to be drawing a lot of the ideas we're going to be talking about today. Hitler had an obsession with America, and with living standards. Timothy Snyder points out in Black Earth that the term Lebensraum, living space, meant the space, not just kind of geographical space in which Germans could live, but the amount of resources that Germans could have. And Hitler frequently said that Germans should really be living like Americans, having those kinds of standards of living. But if you break down the stats, in the decade 1924 to 1935, American national income was three times that of Britain, four times that of Germany, five times of that of France or the Soviet Union. And in that period, British per capita gross domestic product was running at 89% of the US, if you imagine, take the US as being at 100%. The French were at 72%, the Germans at 63%, and the Soviets at 25%. And Hitler, in his second book, the Schweiter book, was aware of this and very conscious of this. And part of Hitler's vision for conquest was that the Wehrmacht, the German army, needed additional resources that would come at the expense of other European peoples. The German people's material standards of living should not, you know, dramatically decrease. Hitler was quite contrary on this. You know, Hitler is a kind of a master of contradicting himself. And throughout the 1930s, he's actually said quite different things. He'd made the case that shortages caused by rearmament were essentially a good thing, and they would build the moral fibre of German people, and the importation of luxuries that was curtailed by the regime. Again, this was important because you didn't want the German people to really have to rely on foreign imports, but more importantly, you didn't want them to be spoiled by luxury. Hitler had this idea that the German people should be essentially toughened up. They were going to be racially toughened up anyway by getting rid of racial undesirables, and they were going to be sort of physically and even spiritually toughened up to be a kind of a Spartan warlike people who could fight on the battlefield and endure hardship on the home front, knowing that this kind of eschatology, this far-off future, this racial future of perfection, was beckoning, and, you know, one had to struggle to get there. Rather like the view of Soviet communism in the mid-1930s, that communism would eventually emerge, but there was going to be a long, long period of struggle in order to build it. Hitler concluded, perhaps correctly, that the American standard of living had been achieved via a kind of a process of creating American Lebensraum, the extermination of the Native American peoples. This was going to be a model, really, for Hitler's actions in building Lebensraum in the Soviet Union. And here Richard J. Evans makes the point that Hitler wasn't descending into medieval fantasy, thinking about the, you know, Friedrich Barbarossa and the Teutonic Knights and fighting Ivan Nevsky on the Russian steppe. He was thinking of a very modern model of conquest and colonization, really that of European powers the American nation in the 19th century. Now, both Adam Tooze and Richard J. Evans have made the point that the economic miracle that supposedly happened after 1933 is greatly overstated. Far too much has been made of it, and really, it is conscription that brings down unemployment. The numbers of jobs created by the Autobahns are relatively small, and the other significant point about the Autobahns is that they don't provide any kind of Keynesian-style reflation of the economy. The wages that the Autobahn workers are paid are extremely low. So low, in fact, that families have to provide foodstuffs for their loved ones not to go hungry. And so there is the old Keynesian maxim that it's better to give a man pay a man to dig a hole all morning and then fill it in the afternoon than to have him go idle, to give a man utterly absurd work and to have him go idle so that he can actually spend money and get the economy working again. This is lost on Hitler. Hitler, by and large, sees work as this kind of a transformational process that it's good for the spirit and to get men out in the fresh air, toiling, and it will do have some kind of transformative effect on their mentality. No longer will they be these sort of lazy urban idlers full of perhaps bohemian or Weimar ideas, which are all tainted, as Hitler strongly believes, with these Judeo-Bolshevist thoughts. No, they'll be out there in the German countryside seeing the mountains and the forests, building outer barns and rejoicing in the glory of the racial community. Which, of course, doesn't happen, because basically, in short, people aren't like that. There were large numbers of people working on the outer barns who were completely unsuited to that kind of work. Accountants, greengrocers, these sort of things. People that had been flung out of work by the Depression, and manual labour wasn't the solution for them. Similarly, men who and women who were sent to work in agriculture, who never worked a harvest before, by and large got in the way and were considered more of a nuisance to German farmers and peasants than a help. And the reality is that the Nazis were very lucky in their timing of when they managed to capture power, because the Depression itself was coming to an end anyway. There was the beginnings of a recovery, and they had inherited some of the works built, the work building programs from Schleicher's government shortly beforehand. The drive for rearmament creates all sorts of tensions and contradictions within the economy. Firstly, it sucks up a large number of resources that could be used for other consumer industries. This means that there are shortages of consumer goods in the shops. At the same time, that munitions workers are being paid higher wages, so you've got more cash chasing fewer products, and this is inherently inflationary. And it's these concerns that see Hitler's finance minister, Jalmar Schacht, eventually sidelined for Goering, who was far more capable of being a yes man to Hitler when he became the Reich Plenipotentiary for the Office of the Four-Year Plan, i.e. getting Germany ready for war by 1940. Obviously, Goering makes as much of an inept mess of that task as he does being head of the Luftwaffe. His singular skill is being able to appeal to Hitler and to know what Hitler's desires and wants and whims are. Schacht was essentially saying we need to slow down rearmament because it's going to overheat the economy. This was an outrage to Hitler because Hitler understood nothing about economics and had no interest in it and was a profound anti-intellectual. He was probably convinced that he was the only intellectual, any person capable of understanding anything at all. But he believed that concepts like economics or sociology were secondary, if not irrelevant, when compared to racial thinking. That the concepts of race were all that really mattered, and because race really explained the entire world. And as a result, he dismisses Hjalmar Schacht. And you reach a kind of a strange dilemma. Some historians, particularly Gotzali, have argued that Hitler tried to cushion the civilian population economically for fear of alienating it. Certainly, there's abundant evidence. If you read Noakes and Pridham's Third Reich Nazi Germany readers, there's tons and tons of evidence there that shows that they were carrying out opinion polls left, right and centre. The SD, the security division of the SS, were spying on public conversations, and they were obsessed with public opinion. For a dictatorship, the level of interest in what people think and the worry about public opinion is immense. But Adam Tooze points out, and he uses lots and lots of data to show it, that
when you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's no economic evidence to claim that they did cushion the German people from the problems of low wages, inflation, and falling living standards. Again, this sort of plays out when you read Richard J. Evans' The Third Reich in Power. You get the impression of there being a constantly sort of aggrieved and dissatisfied, yet largely apathetic population who aren't fanatical Hitler supporters, who by 1938-39 are so disillusioned with politics and so turned off the idea that politics can change their lives for the better in any way, that they become apolitical. Goebbels and Hitler in 1933 didn't want an apolitical population. Central to their ideology was that if the entire population could be mobilised at one time, if all the German people act as one in unison, they were unstoppable. And Goebbels said things to the effect of, this revolution isn't one which will tolerate bystanders, everyone needs to be fully engaged and join in. And that it was a complete revolution and would start to challenge the pre-existing ideas about the purpose of life that German people had and really start to make them shift their ideas towards thinking racially. Now, even though 600,000 Germans died of malnutrition during the Allied blockade in the First World War, Hitler still didn't believe that building up large food reserves or keeping German people well fed during the period of rearmament was as much of a priority as the rearmament itself. There was a debate in Nazi Germany revolving around the idea of guns or butter, and Richard J. Evans makes the point that it was always the guns that won, meaning that rearmament was prioritised over the civilian consumer market. By 1939, one in every five Reichsmarks was allocated to armament spending. Hitler was determined, perhaps from a point of national pride, not to devalue the Reichsmark, and he suffers, therefore, from a shortage of currency. There's a net flow of monies out of the Reich. And the rather ham-fisted and short-termist solution was to loot Jews who attempted to emigrate so that they couldn't take any assets or savings with them. And this actually discourages Jews from emigrating, so it works against Hitler's racial policy in the mid-1930s, which was to enforce Jewish emigration. And this shows really that the Nazi policy was extremely chaotic and contradictory a lot of the time. One initiative would undermine the next. One of the most significant events of this period in November 1937 is the Hossbach Conference, so called because the note taker who took the infamous notes of the conference was Friedrich Hossbach, one of Hitler's adjutants, produced these at the Nuremberg trials. And the Hossbach Conference was a meeting of the heads of the army, the Luftwaffe, the Kriegsmarine, the Navy, and Hitler and Ribbentrop. And there Hitler lays out a timetable for war. But one of the reasons why the conference was called in the first place is it wasn't called by Hitler, it was called by the chiefs of staff to iron out disputes between them about who should get first refusal on resources. There was a shortage of steel. Hitler had enormously ambitious, perhaps over-ambitious plans for aircraft production, particularly he wanted 21,000 planes to be ready by 1939. And there was an intense rivalry and bickering between the Air Force, the Navy and the Army as to who should have sufficient resources. Hitler's priorities was Army first, Air Force second, Navy third. Hitler didn't completely write off the Navy, but he always believed that the Army and the Air Force were really the kind of the most treasured parts of his military and the most important tools that he could have to wage war with. The Hossbach Memorandum was later used to make the case that the Nazis had deliberately planned and launched a preemptive war, which at the Nuremberg trials was the supreme international crime. The war itself, according to Adam Tooze, and there's abundant evidence to suggest this, is fought on something of a shoestring. In the World at War, the 1977 classic documentary on the Second World War, there were accounts by German soldiers who found the abandoned equipment of the British Expeditionary Force at Dunkirk and marvelled at how well, how luxuriously well-equipped the British Army was. In Barbarossa and in the invasion of the West, horses are used in enormous numbers, and the German army as it races across France, it's short on food, on fuel, and is close indeed in some instances to running out of ammunition. And again, I think this is the most important part of this discussion. The idea that the cards were marked for Germany right from the get-go, that Germany wasn't a powerful enough economic player. If you think, neither was Britain. Britain had been through a punishing era of depression up to 1934, and it started to rise out of it in the second half of the 1930s. You have to remember that Britain had an entire empire to rely on to supply it with food during wartime blockade from Germany and to loan it money. It wasn't just America that loaned money to Britain. Canada did. Large quantities of food and manpower could be diverted from India and other parts of the empire. So when the British portray themselves as the plucky underdogs in 1940, completely alone, has to be taken with something of a pinch of salt. Britain was never completely alone. The invasion of Great Britain was a non-starter from the beginning, argues Tooze. There weren't the resources, there weren't the boats to do it, to cross the English Channel. The Nazis were hoping to convert Dutch flat-bottom barges, which was done in a rush job at the last minute, hardly symptomatic of long-term planning. German aircraft production was lower than British aircraft production. The Luftwaffe was losing fighter planes and light bombers at a pace it couldn't afford. And the British, under the guise of Max Aitken, Lord Beaverbrook, reorganised their aircraft production and actually managed to increase it during the Battle of Britain, turning out more fighters than the Germans could contend with. And the difficulty as well is that German fighters and bombers had to travel from Germany and had a short amount of flying time. And fuel suddenly becomes a real premium. And if you think these problems are difficult, imagine the shortages and supply problems in Barbarossa. Sure, it's all very well for Hitler to plan to seize the Ukraine in order to feed the Wehrmacht and the German population. But actually marching into the Ukraine, I mean, 4 million soldiers crossed the border, but the how well equipped they are and the strength of supply lines that are growing every single day, and the ability to provide things like antifreeze for tanks, cold winter clothes for soldiers, rifles that are properly oiled so they don't freeze, these kinds of essential things. That's not high on Hitler's priorities. And Albert Speer himself, when he takes over as Minister of Armaments after Fritz Todt is mysteriously killed, finds that the German munition system is in chaos, that there are factories that are just empty, that there are numbers of dozens of very similar kinds of tanks and jeeps being being produced that and duplicated that don't have to be. And Speer does a very good job of rationalising the entire system, but it's too little too late, because by 1943, the entire economic output of the British Empire, the United States of America, and the Soviet Union are pitted against Germany, and Germany's no way can she compete with all that. Even though, of course, German war production at the time is taking up all spare materials, the decision to annihilate the 30 million Soviet citizens, which isn't finally realised, to free up land and resources in the Ukraine is partly the creation of wartime, but partly pre-planned by the German army as well. It is interesting to note that in the second part of the war, when these serious economic problems are reaching critical point, the Nazi regime is working on developing jet fighter technology, rockets, long-distance U-boats, these wonder weapons, and they have a plan for the atomic bomb. The atomic bomb was probably never going to be feasible in Nazi Germany. If you imagine, the Manhattan Project in America employed something approaching 100,000 people. It was a vast industrial process that the resources of the United States was able to bear. Finally, of course, mass bombing and the destruction of Germany's infrastructure really causes the military economy and civilian economy to collapse. Speer went on record as saying that had Allied bombing during the combined bombing offensive continued for another 6 weeks in 1943, then Germany would have ceased to function. Okay, so I hope you found that useful. You might be studying this, and you might find this useful for your exams, which everyone seems to be having at the moment. If so, do give us a like. It's very helpful, and you know, helps to boost the ratings, and everything gets better as a result. And I'll be catching you next week on Monday, Wednesday, Friday with more Explaining History podcasts. I hope you're enjoying the show, and I'll speak to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.